In the talk this evening, I'd like to reflect a little upon the cause of suffering and the end of suffering. The heart of Buddhist meditation really lies in the teaching of the Four Noble Truths, where the Buddha made some very simple statements about life and about this path. That began with saying that there is in life unsatisfactoriness, there is pain, there are times of suffering. He said, went on to say that there is a cause to suffering, that there is an end to suffering, that it is possible to see the cessation of sorrow, and that there is a path to its end. Now, these Four Noble Truths, I think, are not necessarily very unique to the Buddhist tradition. Within most spiritual paths, one hears these very simple teachings repeated in different ways and in different words. And in a very real sense, they underlie all paths of exploration, paths of transformation, paths in which we seek to bring about change. When we look at the essence of a spiritual path, it is about transformation and movement. It is a quest for peace, intimacy, freedom, happiness. And it is a spiritual path, is also a journey of leaving behind us, or understanding the ways to leave behind us, an ocean of sorrow, separation, and unhappiness. This pilgrimage, or this journey in the Buddhist tradition, is likened to waking up from a dream. All of us begin on that path by perhaps looking at our own initial motivations, our reasons, our wishes to meditate, to practice, to sit. Why we follow this same path that countless people over centuries have followed. In the same way, seeking solitude, as thousands, countless of people over centuries have sought for inner solitude on mountaintops, in caves, in deserts. Would we choose this particular journey if we felt that there was in ourselves and there was in our lives an abundance of happiness, a genuine sense of completeness in our hearts, in our consciousness, in our being? Probably not. I think the enticement or the magnetism of any spiritual journey is twofold. On one level, I think we are magnetized and attracted by the promises or the sense of possibilities of discovering real depths of happiness and intimacy. And I think, on the other hand, we are equally magnetized by the possibility of extinguishing, of finding an end to sorrow and suffering. To do this, I think it is first important or significant to look at what we mean by sorrow, or to look at what is meant by this word suffering. I mean, it sounds like a very dramatic word, you know. When we hear this word suffering, you know, we perhaps visualize people writhing in agony or, you know, undergoing terrible tortures. This is not quite what is meant by unsatisfactoriness, or even by the word suffering in the Buddhist tradition. As human beings, we encounter so many different dimensions of unsatisfactoriness, of sorrow and of suffering in our lives. Some of it is intrinsic to being a human being. As a human being, we have a body, we have a mind, we have feelings, and things inevitably happen within those worlds that we cannot control. Within those worlds of having a body, feelings, and a mind, there are all kinds of events and experiences that each one of us will encounter in this life. They're not all pleasant. There are other levels of unsatisfactoriness, of suffering, that we equally encounter, which are not necessarily intrinsic to being alive or to being a human being, but which are much more born of confusion and misunderstanding. There is the sorrow of loneliness and conflict. There is the deeper sorrow and suffering that we can encounter in our lives that is born of feelings of separation and disconnection and being apart. There's the suffering of feeling separate from others, disconnected from the world around us. There's the pain that is involved in being separated from the things, the people, the feelings, the qualities we look for and long for in terms of happiness and freedom and intimacy, and yet feel apart from. This is suffering that comes sometimes when we feel separate from just getting what we want. And also the suffering of feeling inner fragmentation, of feeling at times in our lives exiled or separated from a genuine sense of authenticity and wholeness and completeness within ourselves. The Buddha described this sense of separation and banishment and disconnection as samsara. Samsara means perpetual wandering, perpetual movement. Samsara is the wandering of restlessness that can seem endless. Then we wander through our lives and through existence as if in a dream. Samsara is described as the wandering of always looking for somewhere where we can feel at ease, where we can feel at home, where there's some place or sense of authenticity. Finding a home, wandering, trying to find a home of peace and well-being, and yet rarely discovering it. So wandering on and on. If we look at our own lives, we can see sometimes our lives are a kind of history of so many different journeys that we have made searching. Some of them very valid, some of them true journeys of learning and discovery. And some of them journeys of frustration and restlessness, a kind of seeking for a place to be at home. So we wander through the world of taking on many different identities, becoming someone. We can wander through the world of taking on many different roles, of trying to have a whole range of different kinds of experiences, a kind of endless search for something. The Buddha also spoke about waking up from this perpetual wandering, waking up from samsara, and discovering that sense of authenticity discovering a kind of ultimate stillness of being, where there's an end to the repetitive cycles of discontent. The Buddha spoke about waking up and discovering a vastness of being, of happiness, of understanding and compassion, and a depth of inner freedom. This quality of stepping out of the cycles of perpetual wandering in the Buddhist tradition is described as awakening, sometimes defined or described as extinguishing the fire. Now, this process of waking up from the dream, it's not a magical process. It's not a process that comes about through somebody waving a magic wand or delivering to us just the right secret teaching that we've always looked for. This sense of waking up is also not a process of time or thinking, and neither is it just an experience. But rather, waking up, I think, is more of a cellular transformation in our being. A cellular transformation where there is a shattering of illusion, a shattering of misperception. And that waking up is born of clear and wise understanding that illuminates misunderstanding. When the Buddha spoke about this process of waking up, he endlessly encouraged people not to think of waking up as some distant destination that would be arrived at as a result of time, as a result of how many hours on a cushion we've put in, not to think of waking up as a kind of an accumulation of merit or particular spiritual experiences. But to seek for that waking up or that quality of wakefulness on a moment-to-moment level, to have a sense of its immediacy, and to know that wisdom unmasks delusion. It is wisdom that brings about the end of suffering. And part of bringing about the end of suffering is deeply understanding the causes of suffering. When we understand the causes of suffering in our lives and in ourselves, then we have choice. Then we have the possibility of not being a participant any longer in the creation of pain. The second noble truth of the Buddha is that there is a cause of suffering. And the Buddha spoke about the cause of suffering as tanha. Tanha means craving. The literal translation of tanha is unquenchable thirst. Unquenchable thirst. I think sometimes when we hear this part of the Four Noble Truths, that the cause of suffering is craving, we may actually feel some resistance to hearing that. On one level, we have a preference to externalize suffering and its causes. And we think we also have an inclination to make suffering something very, very complex. Certainly, it feels easier to externalize the causes of suffering. We find in ourselves sometimes it's easier to blame, and then if we externalize the causes of suffering, we can avoid. Or if we can externalize the cause of suffering in our lives, the causes of conflict in our lives, we have this opportunity suddenly to be propelled into a kind of frenzy of activity and busyness and fixing that makes ourselves feel very secure. in the role of the doer and the fixer. Not always acknowledging that that very role or that very activity of always doing, fixing, avoiding, perfecting actually has the nature of busyness and agitation, which is so much the nature of samsara. Sometimes we might feel that it's too simplistic to say that craving is the cause of suffering. I mean, if you look at your own life, you know, recent past, and reflect upon times perhaps when there was some conflict or tension or pain or feelings of suffering in whatever form, we can probably come up with a whole lot of things that caused us to suffer. A whole lot of things that seem to be the source of that struggle. We might say it was all the things that we don't have and want. It's all the things we want and don't have. It's the busyness of our lives, we might say, that causes us to suffer. It's our noisy neighbors. It's our nagging, critical mother-in-law. It's the countless things that can go wrong in our lives. It's the traffic jams I get stuck in. It's these things that don't work. In fact, sometimes when we look at our own personal world, it can sometimes seem to be filled with circumstances and people and events and the thousands of small irritations whose mission we perceive as being one of being there to cause us to suffering. Externalizing the cause of suffering, I think, also somewhat relieves us of the need to see more deeply, because then we get to blame, which is always somehow more satisfying. If we get to blame, then we don't always have to see the ways in which we might be participating in the process of suffering. It can be more satisfying at times to blame than to question. Other times we take the different extreme position. Some people are very good, much better at guilt than blame. And they say, oh, it's not the world around that causes me to suffer, it's me. It's all of the things that I do wrong. It's all of the mistakes that I make. It's the countless ways that I annoy and harass and disappoint myself. It's my history, it's my conditioning, it's my tangles of confusion that are the cause of suffering. It's an interesting exploration to question what our world would be like if we were willing to withdraw, even for a few moments, all blame. If we didn't blame anyone, not ourselves, not others. If we let go just for some moments of saying it has to be somebody's fault, then we would stay present, have the capacity to stay present with the simple actuality and nature of suffering. And the capacity to explore what that is in that moment. What does that mean for me? How does it happen within me? How do I experience it? How does it express itself? And if we look at those moments in our lives where there is confusion, where there maybe is anger, where there is judgment, where there is greed, where there is conflict, where there is aversion, if we do explore those moments, what is it that we find under the surface levels of those reactions? Surprise, surprise, we often find tanha. We find craving, this unquenchable thirst that we try and seek to quench in different ways. The suffering that comes when we get what we don't want, that happens sometimes. you may have noticed. When we don't get what we do want, this also happens, including what happens on our cushion. There's a suffering that comes when we don't find ourselves satisfied, even when we find what we thought we wanted. The eternal discontent of feeling never enough. Look at restlessness, and look at this force of craving. And what do we see underneath it? Very often what we do see underneath it is a sense of fear and anxiety. A Christian mystic once said that anxiety is the mood of ignorance, the mood of not knowing what is true. Anxiety is as close a companion to this sense of separation as our breath is to our lives. It is so often the sense of anxiety that leads us to want to flee from ourselves and flee from stillness into restlessness, into wandering and wanting, seeking for the completeness and happiness and freedom we long for, and yet often finding frustration. Attempting to alleviate this kind of chronic restlessness through craving is likened to drinking salt water, trying to quench our thirst. If we look at our lives, we see how the presence and burden sometimes of craving, it's like an insatiable appetite. You know, it's like if you break your leg, I don't know if you've ever had this experience where you break your leg and you have a cast on it, and you get an itch underneath the cast, and you keep trying to poke it and find all these very creative and ingenious ways to scratch that itch, and you can never quite get to it. One time, some of you have heard me say this before, one time I was teaching a retreat for children, and we were talking about craving. And I asked this little group of small children, you know, 3, 4, 5 years old, I said, what do you think happens in your life? What do you think you get if you go through life always wanting things? And this little boy piped up in this little voice and he said, trouble. In the Tibetan tradition, it's sometimes depicted, they have this realm called the realm of the hungry ghosts. I don't know if you've ever seen the illustrations of that. And hungry ghosts are supposedly these beings who, through slightly unwholesome ways of being, have ended up in this realm. And these beings have got these enormous, enormous, huge, huge protruding bellies. So they're very hungry. And they have these tiny, thin throats and these pinpricks for a mouth. And this is their life, that they go through life trying to satisfy the hunger pangs from these enormous bellies, which is obviously something of a challenge when you only have a pinprick for a mouth. I wonder if we can imagine, if you can imagine reaching a place in your life where you were able to retire from the appetite of craving. And if you can imagine reaching a place in your life where you had all the pleasant experiences, all the pleasant sensations, all your desires fully gratified, where every single thing you wanted had been fulfilled. And a time in your life, not only where every desire and everything you wanted and had ever been able to imagine wanting had been fulfilled, you got it all, but it also stayed intriguing and interesting for you. That you didn't get bored with it at all. that it stayed exciting and stayed attractive for you. Probably not. There's a wonderful story about a man who died, and he woke up in this realm, and he found himself seated at this great dining table, and there were all these people around to serve him. Everything he'd ever imagined, every delightful food he'd ever imagined eating in his life was brought to him in this endless succession of dishes, and there was entertainment, and there were all these people being kind to him and being there to serve him and please him. You know, and for a few days, you know, he thought this was just, you know, wonderful. You know, he got right into it, was enjoying it, totally delighted. And then more days went by, and he started, you know, it was all like, more? You know, like, who needs more? And so he said to one of his attendants, you know, this is all well and good, you know, and it's been wonderful having all this happening and all you folks serving me and all. But isn't there anything I can do here? And the attendant said to him, no, I'm not sorry. That's the one thing we can't offer you. There is nothing to do here. And the man said to his attendant, well, I might as well be in hell. And the attendant said, well, where do you think you are? It's interesting for us, this whole experience of getting what we want. I mean, I've noticed that not only with myself, but also living with children, especially when they were small, and they would get these infatuations with something, you know, some ridiculous thing that they had to have, you know, like the whole liberation depended on having, you know, Teletubby or, you know, Mutant Turtle or something. And how quickly sometimes to look at the experience of what happens when we get what we want, when our hearts have been really set on something, how quickly we lose interest in it, and how quickly it loses the power to satisfy us. It's like I have an attic filled with these, you know, crisis objects that had to happen at some moment in life. So what happens? Do we learn from this? Sometimes we learn from this. Sometimes actually what happens is that our desires become more sophisticated and they become more subtle and more complex. Perhaps you notice it in the context of a retreat. You know, maybe when you began this retreat, you know, you reflect back to the first day, you know, you came in, you know, you're filled with hindrances, you were agitated, you know, you were restless, you know, your body ached all the time. Most likely that's not happening quite so much. So in that first day or two, you probably perhaps had the thought, oh, all I want is a little calmness. Anything, just for a little calmness, that's all I want to get out of this retreat. Well, maybe it came. And then we have a little calmness, and what happens after a day or so? It's kind of boring. There's calmness. You know, maybe I should have some sort of grand experience. Maybe it's time for that. So maybe even we're lucky enough, we have a grand experience of some sort of other, and we think, you know, oh yeah, this is really it. And then maybe you go to a group, and somebody else has a grander experience. And you think, no, that hasn't happened to me yet. I need to have that one. And so it becomes the next phase of our meditation. Isn't it amazing the way that our minds work? And we wander on and on. This is the reality of samsara. A close friend, of course, to craving is that interesting experience of aversion. Now, very sadly, the world actually is uninformed about our appetites. Most other people around us actually are uninformed of our appetites and the things that we want. So there is a whole lot that comes that we don't actually want. We can find ourselves in a place of perpetual litigation with the world. If only that person was less restless, my meditation would be wonderful, I'm sure. If only I was closer to the front of the lunch line, I would have a much happier afternoon. If only I had a different zafu, then I'm sure I could sit still. If only I had a different body, then I'm sure I would be enlightened. You know, we can find ourselves endlessly arguing with all of that that comes unbidden in our feelings, in our thoughts, in our bodily experiences. And perhaps you have noticed by this point in the retreat how very much there is that comes unbidden. I mean, did you wake up one morning and say, oh, it's a good day to have the hindrances today? No. Did they choose them? No, they come. You know, did you ever come to your zafu and said, oh, it's a terrific sitting, never really aching back? No. So much comes unbidden to us. We find ourselves in this life over and over again in situations that we simply cannot control. And very often in those situations we say, why is this happening to me? This shouldn't be happening to me. Sometimes in these moments one might say we are slightly out of touch with reality. That we are actually not in control of pleasure and pain. I mean, try and have just one day here, even 1 hour. Try to have 10 minutes where you hold on to pleasure. All successful folks, you know, can speak to us at the end of the retreat. Try and spend a day where you are in charge of the unpleasant, where you have the capacity to say in that day or even in a single hour, there is nothing I will encounter in this hour that is unpleasant. Again, be wonderful to see if anyone is successful. Yet somehow we just somehow don't get it sometimes. And we keep thinking we can be successful at this. And so life becomes a place that requires so much effort. Sometimes so much struggle for us as we try to hold on to the pleasant and try to get rid of the unpleasant. In fact, what happens is that our lives become governed and dictated by the power that sensation has on our consciousness, which is actually the power we have given it to determine our sense of well-being and happiness. I think this is probably one of the most important things for us to understand, is that sensation does not have the power to dictate the quality of our well-being. It is a power we give to it. And sometimes busily lost in that tug of war with the pleasant and the unpleasant, we sometimes lose sight of how much we have actually surrendered spaciousness and equanimity and compassion and, above all, freedom. The Buddha spoke about 3 varieties of craving that have an impact on our lives and an impact on our consciousness. He said there is the craving for the pleasant. You know, the pleasant sensations, sounds, sights, thoughts, etc., etc., etc. He said there is the craving for becoming. Whether it's the desire to become prime minister or the Buddha or, you know, an executive or just the craving to become something that is not happening right now. And he said there is the craving for non-becoming, which is the craving to get rid of, to make something end. Now actually these three areas of craving is actually quite a lot to keep us busy. It keeps us pretty busy in our lives. If we look what is underneath this craving, it's always that sense that this is not okay, what's happening. And even underneath that is this sense of fear, the fear of not being able to be with what is happening. Some of you have heard me tell this story about my friend, my insurance salesman. I have an insurance salesman in my life. Sometimes some of you probably have one too. And he comes and visits me every year, and he always tries to sell me more and more insurance. I mean, I have house insurance with him, but he always wants to sell me more and more insurance. And I've discovered after many years of listening to him that the way he tries to sell me insurance is actually, the underlying intent is actually to try and make me afraid. Now, so I must say that this insurance salesman is a lovely person. He really is a very nice guy, and I absolutely enjoy his visits. It's such a treat to listen to this year after year. And it always begins by these words he says to me. He says, "I'm really sure none of this is ever going to happen." He says, "God forbid." He says, "But what if?" And then he goes on and he gives me this long list of disasters that might happen in my life. He says, you know, what if you couldn't work anymore? He says, what if you got really sick and you couldn't teach anymore? He says, what if you broke both arms and couldn't write any books anymore? He says, what if your partner lost his job too? He said, what if your children got really sick? You know, and you didn't have the money to look after them. He said, what if, you know, you got burgled one night and you lost everything? And the list gets longer and longer and more elaborate every year, and my eyes get sort of bigger and bigger as he's kind of describing this sort of hell realm that, God forbid, is ever going to happen to me. And sometimes I sort of visualize what it would be like if the Buddha was in my living room. And he was talking to the Buddha, and he says, you know, impermanence, not a problem, you know, I've got just the policy for you, you know. No self, don't worry about it, you know, you lose it, I've got some way of protecting you against it. You know, it's this kind of endless kind of provocation of anxiety that I can prevent from happening. Or that I can make myself feel better about it if it does happen. Sometimes we see that because of fear and the kind of cravings that come from us, that we get very gripped sometimes. We can get very gripped by our wanting to get rid of, wanting to become. And then when we get very gripped, we get very contracted. Sometimes we're very concentrated. Sometimes it's the most concentrated time of our lives when we really want something. But it's an unwise concentration, isn't it? Because if we look at the quality of that concentration and honestly ask ourselves, does this lead to happiness? Is it a place of well-being? Is it a place of equanimity? Most likely the answer would be no. It's a concentration of tension and contractedness. It's like that old saying, when a thief meets a saint in the marketplace, he only sees his pockets. It's that kind of concentration. What happens when we get very contracted? We close down. We close ourselves off from the world around us, close ourselves off from other people, and we actually are closed off to what's really happening in our own hearts. We don't see the painfulness of that kind of contractedness. We also really alienate, I think, ourselves from our capacity, from the capacity to be compassionate with anything at all, with anyone at all. When we get so entangled in those contracted spaces, whether they're aversion or wanting, it's very difficult to find the space in ourselves for giving, for caring, for sensitivity. It's hardly a way of being compassionate to ourselves. One of my first teachers, one of the greatest things he ever said to me was that letting go is a gift of compassion for yourself. But you never appreciated how true and profound that was at the time. That letting go is actually a gift of compassion for ourselves. Because think of the quality of those spaces of contractedness. How much they are spaces of harshness inwardly. And as we practice meditation, we learn many lessons. We learn the lessons of letting go, and we learn the lessons of stillness and being present. And we learn the lesson of how to be with this energy of wanting. And we see actually that it is an energy. Think of the times when you're very caught in aversion or very caught in wanting something. The quality of energy that is there, and the kind of energy it is, how much it keeps us moving, how the quality of that energy is that it almost compels us to jump out of this moment. That it becomes so difficult to be with where we are because we are grasping hold of something else. Grasping hold of the time when we've got rid of something or grasping hold of the time when we've managed to get something. The feeling of that restlessness, of that craving, the energy of that craving is that we don't want to be where we are. The moment, the experience where we're in. Instead, we look for richness. We look for completeness. We look for happiness somewhere where we are not. So what do we do? What do we learn with this practice? We learn to come back to this place right where we are in this moment. We learn to let go of the ideas of a better moment. The ideal moment where we're going to find peace, where we're going to find happiness. I mean, this sense of dissatisfaction is so pervasive in our world. I read an article in a newspaper once about Mickey Mouse in Disneyland. About this journalist who'd gone to do this story on Mickey Mouse. Some of you may have been to Disneyland. I mean, if you've ever been to Disneyland and ever come across Mickey Mouse, you would probably think it's probably one of the better lives to have in this world. I mean, it seems a fairly unstressful life and job to have. You know, you go around and you wave and you know, you don't even have to smile because it's already painted on the face. I mean, it's not even that much effort. You know, you just kind of hang out and be Mickey Mouse, and all these people are really glad to see you. You know, these little kids admire you, etc., etc. And this journalist overheard Mickey Mouse talking to Donald Duck, and he was saying, you know, I really got to get some overtime in this week. You know, I've got so many hours I'm in debt to my therapist for. You know, I got to get some more work in to pay off my therapist. I mean, this is Mickey Mouse. It's never enough. It is never enough. Baker Roshi once said that the definition of an enlightened person is that they always have what they need. Whether they're on a subway or a mountaintop, whether they're alone or in a crowd, an enlightened person always has what they need. That their sense of richness and happiness and freedom is not governed by sensation or by experience, but that their sense of happiness and freedom flows forth from within themselves, from within a great depth of wisdom. And understanding what is true, that there is nothing that can be added and nothing that can be taken away. And so that no matter what occurs or no matter what is encountered, the idea of imperfect simply does not arise. There is just what is, the suchness of what is. If an enlightened person is someone who always has what they need, then it's not a really huge stretch of the imagination to say that perhaps the definition of an unenlightened person is that they never have what they need. They never feel that they have enough. And so there is craving. It's the active face of separation, trying to gain and grasp, and trying to camouflage the underlying painful feeling of not enough. As long as we are tied into the dance of craving and aversion, we can't be still enough to actually question whether that's true, that there's not enough. And this is what we do in our meditations. We learn to be still long enough to question whether that assumption about not enough is actually true. Whether it's just an assumption that we don't have enough, that we're not enough as a person. Learning to question that assumption. Perhaps it's not true. Perhaps we always have what we need. Perhaps we have everything that we need in this moment for happiness, for well-being, for richness, for completeness. Perhaps we have everything we need right here and right now. Perhaps there has never been a time when there is not enough. There's a wonderful story in the Buddhist tradition about a man called Angulimala. Angulimala was a person who lived at the time of the Buddha who was training and got off the path somehow, and he was training and murdering 1,000 people. And each time he murdered someone, he would cut off one of their fingers and he would wear it in a necklace, a garland around his body. This is probably just a story, by the way. Anyway, he'd gone on happily murdering all these people, and he'd murdered 999 people, which means he was walking around with 999 fingers strung around his neck. He had one more to go, and guess who it was going to be? Of course, it was going to be the Buddha. So he was hiding, he was waiting to ambush the Buddha. And the Buddha walked mindfully down this road, and sometime after he'd gone by, Angulimala jumped out of the bushes and started chasing him. And Angulimala said he was running as fast as he could, and the Buddha was walking very slowly, but no matter how fast he ran, he couldn't get any closer to the Buddha. And so he was shouting at the Buddha, "Stop, stop, stop. Why don't you stop so I can kill you?" You know, and he was shouting at him, "Stop, stop, stop." And the Buddha turned around and he said to Angulimala, "I have stopped, Angulimala. Why don't you?" That's the story. Well, there isn't any more. Well, I mean, there is more. Of course, Angulimala was, of course, liberally and profoundly awakened by these words. "I have stopped. Why don't you?" Essentially, this is what we learn to do in meditation. We step out of the whirlwind of our lives, and most importantly, we step out of the whirlwind of craving. Where do we go? It means that we end up right here with what is and the possibility of opening, that is held within that. As we stop, it doesn't mean that the whirlwind around us stops. Actually, sometimes it even seems to intensify. But what does happen is that as we stop, we are not participating in the whirlwind. And so the energy and the forces of dislocation, the energy and the forces of disconnection and separation become much more visible to us. And in that visibility, there is the possibility of profound understanding. We begin to discover that even in the midst of this whirlwind of sensation and experience, there is a place of calm and stillness, a place of seeing, a place where everything is welcome and all things can be embraced. And as we deepen in that stopping, we begin to discover an unshakable equanimity. We don't enter into the perpetual cycle or the restless wandering of becoming this or that, of not getting and not getting rid of anything. The greatest wisdom in that is discovering that there never was not enough, that we always have everything that we need in each moment for compassion, for learning, for sensitivity, for deepening, that we always have it in each moment. If we take a couple of moments quietly together.